Hello, welcome to Press TV's News Analysis. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. After the fall of the first autocrat Arab regime, Tunisia, during this season of revolutions, U.S. President Barack Obama in his State of the Union address said, quote, "The United States stands with the people of Tunisia and supports the democratic aspirations of all people." Now, some Americans, such as world-renowned political activist Noam Chomsky, have a drastically different take on the role of the U.S. in these uprisings.
A number of months have passed since Tunisian people successfully ended the long-time rule of President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. The popular revolution produced ripple effects across the Arab world. Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and Bahrain followed suit, with the public in each country demanding radical reforms in the way their countries are run. Many saw the uprisings as a major test for the self-proclaimed advocates of democracy and freedom throughout the world, especially the United States. The Arabs wanted to see whether Washington would genuinely support their aspirations. The U.S. first tried to support the lifelong autocratic regimes, then adopted a flip-flop policy toward the revolutions unfolding on the streets of its allied countries. This has drawn criticism from many American intellectuals, including renowned political activist Noam Chomsky. In a recent speech, Chomsky has said the U.S. is actively preventing popular movements to succeed in Arab countries.
The U.S. and its allies will do anything they can to prevent authentic democracy in the Arab world. The reason is very simple. Across the region, an overwhelming majority of the population regards the United States as the main threat to their interests.
Chomsky has also slammed Washington's response to the brutal crackdown of protesters in Bahrain, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia. Despite daily killings and arrests of protesters and activists, the U.S. has supported its staunch allies in these countries so far.
The Saudi-led military forces invaded Bahrain, giving the security forces there the opportunity to crush it violently. Occasionally a sort of a pat on the wrist, but nothing much. That's very much the Carruthers principle.
But in the case of Libya, the U.S., along with members of NATO, chose to intervene militarily in order to preserve its lion's share, namely Libya's massive oil reserves.
The other category is an oil-rich dictator who's not reliable, who's a loose cannon. That's Libya. And there's a different policy. Try to get a more reliable dictator. That's exactly what's happening. Of course, describe it as a humanitarian intervention.
With the Arab uprisings gaining momentum, the White House policies have suffered repetitive blows. This is evident in the way Washington has responded to popular demands for democracy and reform.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, TV reporter and director Phil Rees from London, co-founder Crescent and Cross Solidarity Movement Mark Glenn via Skype from Idaho, and columnist and foreign policy and focus Con Hallinan from Berkeley, California. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, I'd like to cross over to Idaho first and get Mr. Mark Glenn in on this. The U.S. and its allies will do anything to prevent democracy in the Arab world. Your take on Chomsky's perspective?
I tend to agree with what he said. We have to keep in mind that when the United States talks about democracy, what it is talking about is setting up a political system in another country that is going to be favorable to American interests, whether they are business interests, whether they are political interests, or whether it is in seeking Israel's long-term goals in the region. So that when we hear the word democracy coming out of the United States at an official position, whether it is the president, whether it is the Secretary of State, what they're really talking about is making a society, remaking another society along the lines that are going to be cooperative with America's foreign policy and business interests. So in that regard, Noam Chomsky is correct. I would tend to agree with him.
So you're saying, Mr. Glenn, that democracy then being defined by the American administration or officials basically means cooperating with Washington?
Exactly, and with Tel Aviv as well. We have to keep in mind that this is a two-headed beast. It's not just the United States and her political or business interests. The proof of that is that if these Arab countries really succeeded in bringing about true change, and let's say, for example, in the purely democratic model, they voted as an entire nation, as a people, to separate from the United States and instead to throw their good fortunes in with countries such as Iran or with Russia or with China or something like that, the same countries that the United States is so intent upon were seeing democracy flourish would suddenly step in the case that they did in Libya. And so that is what we keep in mind, is that democracy for the United States, it means that democracy is fine as long as it's not going to interfere with long-term or even short-term American foreign policy and business goals. So that's just something to keep in mind. You know, I saw an interesting story on Press TV this morning that said that the a recent poll taken in Egypt said that the Egyptian people wanted to remake their society along Islamic lines, using the religion of Islam as a basis of law. The United States, which has been pushing for democracy now in Egypt for several months and touting the revolutionaries, I guarantee you that this did not make the people in the United States very happy when they heard that the Egyptian people, in a pure democratic type way, are now pushing to have Islam become the law of the land. And so that's how we'll find out whether or not the United States truly is a supporter of democracy, whether or not it steps in militarily in these other countries as it did in Libya.
Okay, well, let me turn to Berkeley, California, and get Mr. Hallin in on this discussion. Now, the United States claims to be the leader of the free world and the supporter and defender of human rights. How is it that we see a wide range of responses to people in the Middle East and North Africa when all of them are seeking their basic democratic rights?
Well, I think my colleague and I was correct. What you need to look at is what are American interests. And understand that the word democracy is a sort of a tactical and ideological phrase. It's not a principle in any manner. And so, you know, there's really no contradiction in American foreign policy between allowing the Saudis to beat up on the Bahrainians and supporting the and attacking Libya. I mean, that's not an inconsistent position for the United States, because it's in the interest of the United States to keep the Fifth Fleet based in Bahrain and to control the Persian Gulf, and it's in the interest of the United States to control the 10th largest oil producer in the world and the largest oil reserves in Africa. This is not new. I mean, there's nothing earth-shaking about this. For the last 100 years, the United States has followed exactly the same policy in Latin America, and there's sort of one dictator or authoritarian regime after another that we've supported, and sometimes we've helped actually overthrow democratic regimes, as we did, for instance, in Chile in 1973. Same is true of Southeast Asia.
Well, you say it's nothing earth-shaking and nothing different, but wouldn't you say the situation that we have right now in the Middle East and North Africa is a little unique in that these movements are taking place in so many countries at the same time, which is very easy for people to see the stark contrast in American foreign policy towards the different countries? Wouldn't you say that that is a little unique element about this situation right now, Mr. Hallinan?
Absolutely. I'd say if I was trying to look for a historical parallel, and that's always difficult to do because they're always, you know, things are very, very different, but in many ways it reminds me of the revolutions of 1848, where again there was a worldwide, in a certain sense, but certainly in terms of Europe, etc., sort of a revolution and rising one country after another. And what we're seeing here in the Middle East, and it's of course not just the Middle East, it's also North Africa, it's mainly North Africa, and it's also parts of sub-Saharan Africa as well. You're seeing, I won't say unprecedented, because I think there are some precedents, but certainly in the last 100 years, it's one of the most dramatic developments we have seen. The fact that the United States is bombing Libya, supporting what's happening in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, it makes it quite clear, I think, I mean, clearer than ever, what it was that was the basis of American foreign policy. And I just want to add in conclusion there, Egypt has already begun to move in a way that it is certainly making people uncomfortable in Washington. And I'm not speaking of the Islamic part, but the fact that the Egyptians helped bring the different Palestinian groups together, that it is going to open its border with Gaza. These are tremendously important developments, and of course they run absolutely counter to U.S. interests and Israeli interests in the region. So in any ways, when I say this is nothing new, I'm not talking about the revolutions. They certainly are new. This is a fantastic development. But what I'm saying is that the policy of supporting democracy when it is in our interest to support democracy, that goes back more than 100 years and covers not just the Middle East, but Latin America and Southeast Asia, etc.
All right, well, let me get turn to London and get Phil Reese in on this discussion. What exactly does all of this mean? Is it that Washington stands for democracy in some places and not in others, or is it that Washington simply doesn't stand for democracy?
I think democracy, clearly, as we've heard from our guests, is a tool of foreign policy. And of course, what democracy implies as well is kind of economic openness. In other words, allowing global capital and indeed the architecture of kind of control around the World Bank and the IMF and other things to have those kind of freedoms to control the country. And of course, they create a reality. They make statements that some things are necessary. Certain policies are needed for that country. So, you know, I think that it comes with a whole lot of language. And indeed, Noam Chomsky in his speech talked about them. They talk about stability, about moderation. All of this kind of language creates a kind of political unit that serves American interests. And I mean, I would add one thing, though, that if I may, and you know, you talk about 1989, which is very important in the American psyche there. And a lot of Americans, and I know this, I spoke to them, they genuinely believe that if people are given the vote, they will sort of want to be American. They'll want to adopt American values. And in a way, that did happen in 1989 with the fall of communism. But when that doesn't happen, and it didn't happen in Algeria in 1991, or indeed in the Palestinian territories when Hamas won those elections, you know, they're sort of stunned. There is actually, as well as a kind of calculated policy, there's a strand in American foreign policy that genuinely believes that if you give this democracy, they'll just want to be like America. And that just isn't true, and it certainly isn't true for the Middle East.
Okay, well, let me turn back to Mark Lynn now. If this is the case, as far as what you and the other guests have been saying, basically, that the United States actually chooses its own interests above everything else, how is it that the United States gets away with projecting itself as a flag bearer of human rights and democracy?
Well, in the first case, because the United States is, militarily speaking, the most powerful entity in the world, it is through its union with the World Bank the most powerful economic entity in the world. And more importantly than that, we have the most powerful media power in the world. The fact that we have Hollywood and all of these things that are used to model and to reshape other societies around the world. And so we really are magicians in many ways. We're magicians. We're able to alter reality for people so that we appear as one thing and we are something else. I'd like to support something else that you said a few moments ago, which is that whether the United States only supports certain democracies or the United States doesn't support democracy at all. I would tend to agree with the latter where there is freedom as far as capitalism goes. Both of my colleagues here brought up the topic of capitalism. Where there is true freedom to choose, capitalism cannot thrive. Capitalism, of course, as much as we are told, it is a supporter of the free market and with competition. In its true essence, it is not. Capitalism, in its essence, is about monopolism. And so they do not want the people to have the opportunity to choose for themselves and to make choices that are in their own best interest. And so for that reason, I would tend to agree that America is not, at least at the highest political and business level, it is not interested in any form of democracy. It is the iron fist in the velvet glove, as they say.
All right. Now, Mr. Hallinan, do you think that with the revolutions in the making, that the besides we've talked about the possibility of showing double standards by the United States and the way it has responded to the various movements, but do you think that the reaction of the United States will affect the U.S.'s influence in the region?
Well, I think the United States' influence in the region has been declining for at least the last 20 years or so. And if you look at poll figures, my colleague from Iowa referred to them at one point, if you look at poll figures throughout the Middle East, North Africa, etc., what you find is that the average person certainly does not hold the United States up as a paragon of democracy or virtue or whatever, that they're pretty cynical about the role of the United States. I think that the United States has immense power, in military and economic power. It's still the number one economy in the world. It spends more on military spending than all of the other countries in the world put together. 51% of all world military spending is by the United States. It's an extremely dangerous country to get on the wrong side of, as Libya is finding out, and say for that matter, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, Yemen, Somalia, etc. So I think that what you do see, however, is that the governments that used to be are somewhat client governments in Egypt and Tunisia, etc. These governments have fallen. I don't know what's going to emerge. I don't know what the final end game is going to be. Alex de Tocqueville once said that the hardest thing in the world is to figure out what the ending of life and novels are. Those are the hardest things to write. I don't know what the end is going to be here, but I don't think the world is going to be the same. I think the United States is losing more and more influence, which doesn't make it any less dangerous, as its ability to project power both economically and militarily. I think this is going to be a dangerous era. I think this next decade is going to be very dangerous. And I think that we in the United States are going to have to talk about what our priorities really ought to be in terms of both foreign and domestic policy, and those things are closely related.
Now, when you say you believe that we're entering a dangerous era, can you expand on that? What exactly do you mean?
Well, for instance, one of the things that happened right after the bombing of Libya was that the North Koreans held a press conference in which they said, "We told you so. See, you got rid of nuclear weapons, and look what happened. You got bombed. Nobody's bombing us because we have nuclear weapons." One of the you know, ripples that's going to spread out from the bombing of Libya is that small countries all over the world are going to say, well, you know, the only way you can hold these people off is if you get nuclear weapons, which means that you've essentially torpedoed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. In the next 10 years, I think you're going to see that treaty very, very badly dented. Ask yourself, 10 years from now, if we have 6 or 7 other countries or more that are now developing or have developed nuclear weapons, is this a safer world? Well, no, it's a much more infinitely dangerous world. And that's the kind of blowback that you get from an unthinking, well, not unthinking, but a policy like attacking Libya.
Okay. All right, well, let me get Mr. Reese back in on this now. Since the overthrow of the regimes in Tunisia and Egypt, do you think that Washington will now go along with the will of the people, at least in these two countries? Or do you think that they will be continuing to be involved in trying to influence the future direction of these two governments?
I think they're already trying to influence them. Remember that they do have leverage. I mean, it couple of billion dollars goes to the Egyptian military. So, you know, they do have power, and that economic power is often used to threaten countries that if they don't follow their wishes, then they will suffer. And indeed, at the end of the day, that leads to sanctions, and they try to, you know, apply their economic power to punish countries that don't follow their views, even if those views are democratic. So yes, I mean, my understanding from Egypt is even the deal which was referred to earlier, made between Hamas and Fatah, that there was a great deal of diplomatic pressure put on the Egyptian military in order to prevent that happening. Now, you know, whether it will work or not, we don't know yet. How complete these revolutions will be, we don't know yet. But certainly what America is doing there is trying to manage those, trying to basically give limits to democracy. So whatever else is decided by the people, that democracy will not offer choices that will be against the interests of Israel or American strategic interests in the region.
Okay, now Mark Lynn, as we're witnessing the formation of a, are we witnessing actually the formation of a new Middle East? And if so, what type of relations do you foresee this new Middle East having with Washington?
Well, the first thing that I would like to address is what Mr. Hallinan said just a few moments ago, which is that we're entering a very dangerous period here, and throughout the entire coverage of the entire revolution process that we've been watching for the last 3 months, I don't know that I've heard anything more profound than what he said. It is a very dangerous period, because if the United States and Israel, if they really do manage to lose control of these governments, these compliant governments in that part of the world, they are going to up the ante, as the saying goes, and they are going to apply even more desperate measures to maintaining the kind of control that they have enjoyed now for not just decades, but for generations. So that's number one. Number two, I think we are entering a period of great change. Personally, I hope to see that these governments in that part of the world are going to start acting in the best interest of their people. And, of course, that means getting rid of these very bad relationships that they have had now with Washington and with Tel Aviv for a long time. This is all about exploitation. This is about projecting Israel's foreign policy in the region. And we know, based upon the history of the last 6 years, that this is not good not only for the region but for the entire world. The entire world now finds itself in complete upheaval because of one tiny little country's ability to influence the military and political machinery of the United States. So, yes, we are entering a very dangerous stormy season, as it were, with everything that is going on. And we have to keep in mind that the United States and Israel, they are playing for keeps, and I do think that there is no depth that they will not sink to. And anybody who has any questions about that should ask the Japanese about what happened in 1945.
Okay, and Phil Reese, where do you see this all going at this point in time? And of course, we all know that no one knows 100% exactly what's going to happen. But with the scenarios that have been set up, we know what's going on in Yemen and Libya and Bahrain. What do you see is the overall answer if the people of this region want to stop themselves from being oppressed? And on the other hand, we've said on this program the power of the U.S.'s military and the media. So what do you see as the answer?
I think the people of this region have to continue their protests. I think that the Islamic awakening is very much in its early days. I think that Tunisia and Egypt have only gone part way. Those stories have yet to reach conclusion. And I think what happened in Libya, one of the key reasons why Britain and France became involved there, because they wanted to play a role in what was happening in the Middle East, because they'd been wrong-footed in the months earlier. They didn't know what was going on. Now they've got their fingers firmly there. And of course, when it comes to Bahrain, Yemen, there's been a definite attempt to prevent popular will being exercised in those countries. I mean, in Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh may go, but the Saudis are deeply involved in who will replace him. So I think that actually the whole Arab Spring, if you will, has had a chill wind going through it, largely led by Saudi Arabia and backed by the West. So, you know, there's been a progress. I think one of the big crimes of the last half century of the last century was the denial of democracy in the Middle East. It was concerted. You know, people talked about the Arab street as if it was an odd bunch of violent people. That was the view of the people. And yet, in terms of the Western media, the dictators and the autocrats were described as representing something. They didn't represent anything at all. But at the moment, all right, we are only at the beginning, in my view. I think there is so much more that needs to happen.
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank all my guests for this program, TV reporter and director Phil Rees from London, co-founder of Crescent and Cross Solidarity Movement Mark Glenn via Skype from Idaho, and Colin Ibsen, Foreign Policy and Focus, Mr. Con Hallinan from Berkeley, California. Thank you all for being with us, and thank you, viewers, for staying with us as we took a close-up look at one of today's top stories. Join us same time, same place tomorrow. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out from Tehran. Goodbye.